This morning is a memorable day for my sister Diane Wood and myself because for the first time we sit with our sister Diane Sykes. And we're very thrilled to have you. Of course, I can't just talk about the Judge Diane anymore. I'm now going to have to get more formal. Here we are. The first case for the day is Appeal 031167, United States versus Paul Cecchini. Mr. Maravis, good morning.
Judge Sykes, it's a privilege to be the first.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Judge Rovner, Judge Wood, Judge Sykes, Andy Morovitz, Lauren, Frank Knoll for the appellant. In January of this year, this court in Green upheld the DNA Act as applied to a prisoner in Wisconsin. The status of the appellants in that case as prisoners were crucial. The fact is, at the time, it gave this court the opportunity to distinguish two Supreme Court cases, Edmonds and Ferguson, both of which controlled this case.
Mr. Maravis, before we do much more, I'd like to talk to you about the fact that it seems to me it's impossible on this record to determine whether Mr. Cecchini was on parole or probation. We really don't have anything to review except a conclusory minute order from the judge below. So let me ask you, just right off the bat, did Mr. Cecchini challenge his parole revocation on the grounds that he was not on parole? If not, has he now conceded he was on parole?
Mr. Cecchini is not on parole, and he has challenged his parole revocation hearings in Ohio, as I understand it, and we are not counsel to him there, but I understand his position in Ohio has been that he is on probation, and we believe the documentary evidence and the statutes before this court show clearly that he is on probation. For example,
well, maybe not clearly, but I mean, we understand that you think that there are documents filed in the Ohio proceeding that would indicate that he's saying that the parole commission had no authority over him?
I'm sure, having spoken with him, that he has taken the position in Ohio that he is a probationer and not a parolee. Yes, Judge Wood.
Okay.
What's important to remember in all of this, however, is that the parole commission itself, the guidelines, Section 2.39B, say clearly that parole and probation are to run concurrently when they are generated by federal statute. So while it is Mr. Cecchini's position that he's on probation and not parole, even the government's argument that he is on parole makes no difference. He is at the very least on probation, and therefore the district court and this court has jurisdiction.
I take it that it's your view that there would be absolutely no reason to remand for some findings by the district court as to where we are.
Yes, Judge Roker. And I think that's the government's view as well, although Mr. Hines will speak for the government. The government below took the position that this was a matter of law governed by statute, and therefore this court is every bit as able as the district court to find whether or not Mr. Cecchini is on probation.
But I want to go back to something you just said. You said even if he is on parole, he's also on probation. I understand the government to be arguing quite to the contrary, that he was on, aside from all of the mistakes that may have been made in terms of labels, that he, as a matter of law, had to have been on this other type of parole, if you will, the mandatory release, not the more discretionary kind of parole that the parole commission, even today, 20 years into the sentencing reform process, is still giving, and thus any probation he might have been entitled to hadn't had a chance to start yet. They said it wouldn't even start until 2010.
Judge Wood, I'd ask the court to look at A14, which is the judgment and probation commitment order, which we've attached to our appendix. The sentence that was handed down at the time, in all the very small types, says, said sentence on count 5 to run consecutively to the term of imprisonment imposed on each of counts 1 and 3. It did not say, which it could have said, and which is said all the time, until the count has been completed. It says term of imprisonment. As soon as Mr. Fazzini left the penitentiary, he was on probation. And I need to be crystal clear about this. It is not Mr. Fazzini's contention that he was on both. It is Mr. Fazzini's contention that he was on probation and probation alone, and the original sentence at A14 certainly supports that. All that we are saying now is that even if the court adopts the government's point, that doesn't mean for any reason that he is not also on probation, and we believe that Parole Commission Guideline 2.39B, the government's own Parole Commission Guideline, sets out that both probation and parole are to run concurrently.
Now help me with this. Some sort of final order was entered on January 10th at that hearing in front of the district court. It's unclear what the court was doing, for, to me at any rate, at the January 10th hearing. I mean, the judge appears to have sua sponte reconsidered his November 7th minute order, and it's unclear to me if the judge was reconsidering all the arguments that Mr. Fazzini raised, or if he was only looking at the religious objection. So I need some help with that, and I want to apologize for not looking straight at you. I am having a problem with an eye.
I'm sorry to hear that, Judge Rovner. No, no.
And that goes for all of you.
I'm not so presumptuous as to read Judge Zagel's mind on January 10th a year ago, but Judge Zagel expressly discussed the Christian Science objection that was raised by Mr. Fazzini. He also addressed at that hearing the government's oral motion for an order to have Mr. Fazzini comply with the terms and provisions of his probation officer. And even if you put aside the reconsideration, that oral motion is a proper ground on which to appeal. And as a result, we appealed. In fact,
do you see this as a 1291 or a 1292A1 appeal?
I think it's both, Judge Wood. I think that we are appealing both from the reconsideration, which this court in Lowry made perfectly clear is an appropriate way in which to appeal, that even a sua sponte reconsideration is appropriate as long as you appeal within the time period following the reconsideration. And we are also appealing from the government's oral motion, which was granted by Judge Zagel, to have Mr. Fazzini go ahead and comply with the probation officer. Again, it's important to remember the context of this. Mr. Fazzini didn't invite this process. The government brought him into court. It threatened to hold him in contempt. It got an order from the district judge, and now it's saying, you don't have jurisdiction. I mean, that's a bizarre turn of events. All Mr. Fazzini was trying to do was to protect his constitutional rights, and he was at risk of being jailed at the time. This court has jurisdiction, appellate jurisdiction, and the district court had district jurisdiction, federal subject matter jurisdiction as well. Unless there are more questions about jurisdiction, or if there are, I'd be happy to answer them.
I mean, my basic concern about jurisdiction, frankly, is this intermediate status, the mandatory release status. That I feel like I have your answer to that, so we'll probably be discussing with the government as well. But if you'd like to talk about it, I think your biggest problem in terms of the underlying merits are the fact that unequivocally he is not yet finished with the criminal justice system, right? He was on either probation or parole and thus subject to a far greater degree of supervision, which this court has already discussed in one case.
It discussed it in Green, Judge Wood,
yeah.
But it discussed it in the context of prisoners, and unless the court wants to go the extra step, that is, prisoners and probationers are exactly the same for all purposes.
Well, or perhaps for this purpose. I mean, you know, Judge Easterbrook's concurring opinion there goes on to Categories 3 and 4. We don't have to worry about his Category 3 of people who are finished as opposed to, you know, people who've never even been involved in the criminal justice system, his Category 4. But Category 1 and 2 are respectively prisoners and those who are still under a constraint. You could bring a habeas corpus action, couldn't you?
Judge, let me respond to the first question about Judge Easterbrook's Category 2 in Green. Judge Easterbrook's Category 2 in Green makes perfectly clear that the reason that the probation or parolee or conditional release person is under a similar tie is because he has made a choice. He has decided to accept the conditions the government has imposed or the court has imposed as a result of being released. Here, Mr. Fizzini had no choice. Mr. Fizzini was released in 2001 without any kind of agreement with the government that his DNA could be taken, without any kind of condition of his probation that blood tests would be taken. Under Judge Easterbrook's own formulation in Green, this doesn't fall within Category 2. That was crucial to the concurrence of Judge Easterbrook.
Now, would you... Oh.
I was just going to say, on that very point, A15 of your appendix lists the general conditions of probation. I'll wait a second. And paragraph 6 of those general conditions says, in equally tiny print, the court may change the conditions of probation. And so it seems to contemplate that when you decide to take advantage of something like probation, you're aware that you're giving the government or the court a blank check, and more than that, you're making an assumption that the only way to get a DNA test is through extraction of blood, and I don't even know if that's empirically correct.
That assumption has been made because that's the way the government has told Mr. Fizzini that it intends to analyze his DNA. That's just this case.
So if there were a non-invasive way to do it, like taking some saliva or a cheek swab or something, he wouldn't mind?
I still think it's two searches. The first search is the taking, and the second search is the search of DNA within the sample. But the fact is that the privacy interest is slightly different under Schmerber and the other cases.
Right.
Cold blood
you wouldn't
is
have a Schmerber
other.
Problem
right.
for saliva, presumably.
It's different. To address, Judge Wood, your first question about subparagraph 6 in our appendix, the fact is, if the government and the court are permitted to put in any kind of conditions or probation that a probationer will follow any law that is set down by the court, then the conditions of probation are meaningless. The fact is that the probationer, even under Judge Easterbrook's analysis, has to have some idea as to what it is that he's consenting to. And it can't be the law, and it isn't the law, that there's a blank check, as you put it.
Okay. Very quickly, but would you concede here that the district court did not give the merits serious consideration?
This case has been before the district court since we were appointed appellate counsel two or three times, so I've appeared before Judge Zagel several times. I think he has considered it fully. I think this is a matter of law, and respectfully, I think this panel should decide that matter of law. I think Judge Zagel did give it consideration.
You think we have enough from Judge Zagel?
And from the record that's before this court, I do.
Well, okay.
Is the defendant still subject to this order regarding the DNA sample now that his parole has been revoked on separate grounds?
The government and the defendant have entered into a stipulation that his DNA would not be taken until all of his appeals have been exhausted.
So this is academic?
It's not academic in the sense that this case presents this panel with the question of whether or not a probationer, according to our way of thinking, is subject to this kind of unlawful search and seizure. This is not a case like Green where the government is trying to take a sample from a prisoner. That's just not the status of this case.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Hines.
Good morning, Judge Wood. Good morning, Judges Wood, Sykes. I'm Stephen Hines, the Assistant United States Attorney assigned to this matter. Actually, I'd like to address very quickly something that Judge Sykes just raised, your question as to whether this was an academic matter. Actually, to a large extent, I think it is an academic matter at this point. As you know from the materials that have been, the record's been supplemented with, earlier this year, the U.S. Parole Commission held a revocation hearing for Mr. Fazzini after he was arrested in Ohio. It has revoked his parole, and he's been ordered to be remain in custody until the year 2008.
And the grounds for revocation are entirely separate from this DNA issue.
That's correct. It had absolutely nothing to do with it. It had to do with him being arrested on an Ohio highway, traveling 95 miles per hour with a number of materials that appeared to be related to potential bank robberies or convenience store robberies that he might have been contemplating. So, and that's set forth in those materials.
Are you arguing that the November 7th minute order is a final order on the merits of Fazzini's challenges to the DNA Act?
Yes, Judge. The November 7th order was a final order. And in fact,
But there's no Rule 58 judgment ever entered by the district court, is there?
The only thing entered by the district court was the minute order. That was
right. So I was concerned about that same thing. And under our in-bank decision in Otis,
right.
Although sometimes things are final enough to appeal from, if there's no Rule 58 final judgment, there can be more than one moment at which a judgment is final. And it seems from Judge Zagel's later decision to take a look at this in January that he didn't think the last word had been said. Now, you would be on very strong ground if there had been a Rule 58 order entered, and I think at that point we would have had to consider the January 10th order under something like Rule 60. We at least would have had Rule 60 jurisdiction, so I don't know that we have no jurisdiction. The question is how broad is the review, but without that Rule 58 order, I'm not sure that you can make this argument.
Well, I don't know that a judge in that situation would be filing any Rule 58 order.
But the point is, for finality, I mean, that all of these rules, that's why Rule 58 is there, so we don't have to have these kinds of problems. So there's that issue. And the other thing that does strike me is it looks an awful lot like, from the transcript in January 10th, that among other things, Judge Zagel is issuing an injunction. And if there's 1292A1 jurisdiction, we don't really have to worry about what happened in November or January or anything.
I don't know.
The order to cooperate with the marshal in the taking of the DNA stands on its own, doesn't it?
Number one, I don't think that's something that Mr. Fazzini actually appealed from. Just to back up.
Well, how can you say that?
Well,
he doesn't want the DNA taken.
No, I say that because he filed a notice of appeal on January 17th.
Right.
And in that notice of appeal, he specifically said that he was appealing from the district court's denial of his motion to enjoin enforcement of the DNA Act.
And well, you can also appeal from the denial of an injunction if you want to put it that way.
Well, but he specifically said what he was appealing from, and he did not, in that notice of appeal, say that he was appealing from any additional order of the court or from any ruling on a motion, an oral motion by the government as counsel.
Mr. Hunt, do you agree, as Mr. Maravich intimated, that in there's no need to send this back to Judge Zagel to clear up all of these questions and issues?
Actually, Judge, I do agree. I think this court can rule on the jurisdictional issue, and by that I should distinguish. There are two jurisdictional issues. I mean, the first argument that the government's made, and that I would like to address in just a moment, is that the district court did not have jurisdiction. The second argument, which goes to some of the questions that Judge Wood was asking a moment ago, relates to the jurisdiction of this court based on the timeliness or lack of timeliness of the appeal. But I believe that just based on the sentencing orders themselves, as well as from the law, Title 18, Section 4163, Section 4164, Section 4205, if you look at the law and the sentence that was imposed in this case, you can determine that, in fact, the district court did not have jurisdiction.
That would require, though, us to make the finding of fact that he really was on parole.
Parole,
and I take it do you agree that he is contesting this in the Ohio proceedings? Has he properly preserved that?
I agree that he did make that objection, and it was found.
Right.
It was rejected. And
it was rejected,
yes.
Of course, but is he appealing? I mean, you know, in other words,
I don't know
the parole commission had no jurisdiction to revoke his parole, then something would have to be undone with respect to the Ohio proceedings, I take it.
Presumably, but I don't know what, if anything, he's done to pursue that in any kind of appeal.
Can we decide without knowing that?
Yes, I think Your Honors can decide just simply, again, based on the facts of what he was sentenced to and what the law mandates. He was sentenced originally to 50 years, and then that sentence was reduced to 25 years, but it was 25 years on multiple counts of imprisonment to be followed consecutively by a 5-year term of probation. Contrary to what counsel suggests, that 25-year term of imprisonment did not end the day that he was released from custody and released on mandatory release. Mandatory release, as the statutes provide, and they're still in effect, although there's certainly a limited number of people that this pre-guidelines law applies to.
Of course, he didn't serve 25 years.
No, actually, that's true. He actually was released from custody a little more than 15 years after he was first arrested. So it was the law, Title 18, Section 4163 and 4164, which mandated that although he wasn't eligible for parole per se, which would have maybe allowed him to be released after he had only served one-third of his sentence, he was still entitled to be released before the 25-year period ended based on good time credits. And that's the mandatory release that he was released from. But he was still serving that 25-year term of imprisonment and will still be serving that 25-year term of imprisonment until sometime in the year 2010.
But I thought that the statute that you're relying on refers to this interim period, the mandatory release period, as a form of parole, not as a form of imprisonment.
He's still serving that term.
I understand the link, if you will, between mm-hmm. the period of time represented by the good time credits and the term of imprisonment, but he was physically not in prison, and B, the statute that allows, shall we say, the continued supervision of him calls what his status is a form of parole, not a form of imprisonment. So that takes us back to Mr. Maravich's textual argument from this judgment and commitment order that says that these things, that the probation term runs consecutively to the term of imprisonment. We have to understand whether that means forms of parole also under mandatory release or whether it just means time when you're behind bars.
Judge, I think if you look at the sentencing orders, the sentence of probation was to be consecutive to the sentence that he served on the other counts.
Well, maybe what you're focusing on is the word the term of imprisonment as opposed to the fact of imprisonment or something. I mean, we need to find something in this order that would justify your reading, or we need to rethink whether your reading is right.
Okay. Well, I think the authorities that we cited in here talk about how that is, in fact, I mean, his sentence is on those counts for the 25-year imprisonment term does not end until he successfully completes either 25 years in custody or a lesser period of time plus the period of time on parole. And so, you know, the 5 years...
Of course, there's no parole for his 924C anyway, so...
There's no parole in terms of getting out after one-third or so of the sentence. That's true. But he still... this is set up forth in the briefs too. There were similar arguments made decades ago in cases relating to narcotic statutes which provided for no parole. And the courts very clearly said the fact that there's no parole, the sentence doesn't end when the period of actual physical presence in the prison terminates. It actually continues, you know, and the person is still on parole under the jurisdiction of the parole commission, which is again what we're dealing with, whether he was under the jurisdiction of the parole commission or the district court at this time until the termination of that period of time.
Now,
here's 25 years.
Sure. I forgive me for, you know, beating a dead horse, but The district court found that a hearing would have to be held to answer the question, but declined to hold the hearing unless this court ordered it. Can you explain that to me?
Well, like counsel, I guess I'm a little reluctant to try and predict exactly what was going on in Judge Zagel's mind. Well, the judge did say, actually, if you read what the judge said in one of our appearances before the court, he did say that he thought that this court could decide as a matter of law that Mr. Fazzini was still on mandatory release, where it was on a form of parole rather than probation at the time. He said that was a pure legal matter, and because that was a pure legal matter, he wasn't going to get into it. He didn't want to look into the factual matter because it hadn't been presented to him before, and it wasn't. He explained that it wasn't part of his rationale or his ruling the way he did previously, and so he didn't think he should be revisiting that unless the court directed him to. But that's the best explanation I can give, I guess, as to what was going on in his head. I would like to also mention one other thing. Counsel referred to a parole commission rule, which he says supports his theory that Mr. Fazzini was actually on probation at the time that all this took place. Counsel only referred to this rule in his reply brief, and so the government hasn't had any chance to respond to that at all. He's actually mischaracterizing the rule. It's Rule 2.39B of the U.S. Parole Commission rules, and it says the parole of any parolee shall run concurrently with the period of parole or probation under any other federal, state, or local sentence. The operative word there is other. It's not referring to the parts of the sentence from the same case. It's referring to a different case.
So you're saying to focus in on these legal propositions that maybe Judge Zagel thinks we can decide, one of them is the proper characterization of this mandatory release term. Is it, in fact, part of, does it mean the term of imprisonment has ended, or does it not mean that? That's just a legal question, interpreting things. And I suppose the other is, whether it is possible, as you've just articulated, within the same sentence to be simultaneously under both parole and probation.
And how does it mesh, in your view, with whatever is happening out there in Ohio? What is happening in Ohio?
The last I heard, they had held the parole revocation hearing. They had found that he had violated the conditions of his parole in four different respects and issued a notice to him saying that his parole was revoked, that he was going to remain in custody for another 52 months.
In a federal prison?
At the time that this hearing took place, he was actually in a county jail. I believe he was in Preble County, Ohio, jail. I don't know if he's been transferred yet. The last I heard, he had not yet been, but okay. I don't know. I could find that out if you're honest.
Mr. Maravich,
is he facing state charges?
I don't know. Take it back. There were some state charges or local charges, and he pled guilty or pled no contest to those.
And does Ohio have a DNA sample law?
I believe just about all the
so is he going to be in the system anyway, so this is really more academic than...
That may be one other way that this is an academic exercise, Your Honor, yes.
Can you think of a way we can punt it to Ohio?
Well, you may be able to, but I don't think that's necessary, Judge. I think you have enough of the fact and the law here that you can definitively say that he is still on mandatory release, or was at the time that the district court didn't have jurisdiction. And then, again, based on the other arguments that we've made, we also argued that his appeal wasn't timely, and thus... this court didn't really have jurisdiction over the appeal. I think this court's previous decision in the Green case in January of this year, which, Your Honor, Judge Rovner was a part of the panel, very clearly takes care of the Fourth Amendment argument that he's raised. There's really no way to distinguish that case from this one in any meaningful way. The other arguments that he's made on constitutional grounds were actually not raised before the district court, and I think they're adequately addressed in the brief, but if Your Honors have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Maravich, how much time? 2 minutes?
Thank you, Judge Rovner. First, I think four or five points, if I can get to them. Mr. Hines' reading of the Parole Commission guidelines about other sentences is applicable here. Mr. Fazzini was sentenced on two different counts. He was sentenced for the bank robbery, and he was sentenced for having the robbery with a gun. There are separate statutes in the judgment and probation commitment order. It's under 2113 and 924C. So that provision applies four square to this case. Second, I think it is patently unfair when Mr. Fazzini asked for a lawyer at the district court level and asked for a lawyer at the appellate level and was denied a lawyer until we were appointed to hold him to a lawyerly standard of filing a notice of appeal. It is true that Mr. Fazzini's notice of appeal said what it said as of January 17th, but he did that on his own, and to hold him to a lawyer standard and to say he didn't ask for this, this, and this, I think is unfair, and this court's waiver principles recognize that. Third, Mr. Fazzini has, as I understand it, currently a habeas challenge with respect to his sentence in Ohio, and I'm told at least that that court awaits with bated breath this court's resolution of this case. And finally, as to whether or not this court should keep the case or send it somewhere else, I guess I ask one question in return. What facts does this court not have that the district court will have access to? That is, what
the district court's mind.
But the district court was not the sentencing court in this case. The district court is a totally different judge, and I don't think there is any fact that the government has identified or that we've identified that this court needs that Judge Zagel has. Everything is in the papers and in the statute, and that's why, respectfully, I would ask this court to resolve the issue. And for the reasons that we stated, this is a very different case than Green. It's true they both use the word DNA, but to apply what this court did for prisoners with no, if I can finish my sentence, right?
Absolutely.
With the reduced privacy interest that prisoners have, and to apply it to a condition on a probationer who has not adopted the very condition that Judge Easterbrook thought was so important in Green, seems to me a stretch that this court ought not to take it and instead ought to follow Edmonds and Ferguson. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement. A moment of personal privilege. Your great uncle would be very proud of you, Mr. Meredith. And mm-hmm. Mr. Hines, all of your great uncles would be very proud of you.